From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is very personal for me. It's not just political, it's not just public. I see what's happening, and we have to reverse it.
I came in from the outside. I brought change to every organization I've been involved with. That message, by the way, of bringing real change, is sweeping the country.
As candidates make their last-minute push in the first primary of the 2008 election, we'll look at the link between front-loading of the primary calendar and campaign financing. A staggering $400 million, at least, has been spent by candidates so far. Where's the money coming from? Then how to rig an election? We'll speak with a former Republican operative who served time in federal prison for jamming phone lines on Election Day in New Hampshire. That was in 2002. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters head to the polls today for New Hampshire's Democratic and Republican primaries. Every major opinion poll indicates Senator Barack Obama will beat Senator Hillary Clinton, just as he did 5 days ago in Iowa. Over the last three decades, every presidential candidate who's won in both Iowa and New Hampshire has gone on to win the party nomination. The Republican race appears to be a much closer fight between Senator John McCain and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. On Monday, Hillary Clinton made headlines after she momentarily choked up with tears filling her eyes when discussing why she was running for president.
This is very personal for me. It's not just political. It's not just public. I see what's happening, and we have to reverse it. And some people think elections are a game. They think it's like who's up or who's down. It's about our country. It's about our kids' futures. And it's really about all of us together. You know, some of us put ourselves out there and do this against some pretty difficult odds. And we do it, each one of us, because we care about our country. But some of us are right and some of us are wrong. Some of us are ready and some of us are not. Some of us know what we will do on day one, and some of us haven't really thought that through enough.
Senator Barack Obama is continuing to enjoy a wave of new support from across the country following his victory in Iowa. Obama is expected to pick up a major endorsement in Nevada later this week from the largest union in the state, the Culinary Workers Union. Nevada holds its primary on January 19th. During a campaign stop in Lebanon, New Hampshire, Obama vowed to help lead the fight against global warming.
In one day's time, we have a chance to break the lock that big oil has on our economy and our foreign policy. You know, we know what to do. If we increase fuel efficiency standards on cars to 40 miles per gallon, we save the equivalent of all the oil we import from the Persian Gulf. We know that climate change is real and that we have to cap the emission of greenhouse gases.
On the Republican front, Mitt Romney has shifted the tone of his campaign, is now presenting himself as an agent of change. He's repeatedly questioned whether Senator John McCain could beat Barack Obama in November.
There's no way that somebody inside Washington, a Washington insider, is going to be able to turn Washington inside out. It's one reason why I'm running. I don't have years and years of favors I have to repay, lobbyists who've raised all sorts of money for me, deals I've worked out in the cloakroom. I came in from the outside. I brought change to every organization I've been involved with. That message, by the way, of bringing real change is sweeping the country.
Tensions between the United States and Iran appear to be increasing after an incident on Sunday when three U.S. warships were approached by Iranian boats in the Straits of Hormuz off the Iranian coast. The U.S. claims five Iranian Revolutionary Guard speedboats came within 500 yards of the U.S. warships and threatened to blow them up. The Iranian boats backed away before the American warships opened fire. The Pentagon described it as a serious provocation. This is State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick.
We would urge Iran to refrain from any provocative actions that could lead to dangerous incidents in the future. Again, part of what we're trying to do is make sure that the Iranians don't have an easy pathway to engage in behaviors that are either illicit or antithetical to the interests of the region or the United States.
The incident occurred just prior to President Bush's trip to the Middle East. That'll include his first visits to Israel and the West Bank as president. Israel's planning its largest security operation since the Pope's visit in 2000. A security force of more than 10,000 officers will be on duty to protect President Bush. Police say the president's hotel in Jerusalem will resemble Fort Knox. On Monday, President Bush said he wants to help push talks between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
They said, well, are you going to have a timetable? One timetable is the departure of President George W. Bush from the White House. Not that that, you know, I'm any great, you know, heroic figure, but they know me and they're comfortable with me, and I'm a known quantity. And therefore, the question is, will they decide to make the efforts necessary to get the deal done while I'm president? Mm-hmm. As opposed to maybe the next person won't agree with the two-state, or maybe the next person will take a while to get moving.
In Pakistan, the party of slain Pakistani opposition leader Benazir Bhutto is calling for a United Nations inquiry into her assassination. Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party has aired deep suspicions over the motives and identities of her assassins. PPP Information Secretary Sherry Raymond said it was important for the region's stability that the UN intervene.
It is very important, not just for Pakistan's stability, but the region's stability, that the United Nations intervene. We ask for that it will be a larger than a police investigation. We want the events that led up investigated. We want the sponsors, financiers, organizers, and perpetrators of this crime. This is UN language, and the UN does intervene when there is a fundamental violation and grave violation of fundamental human rights, and there is no bigger violation of our rights than this.
On Monday, a team of Scotland Yard investigators visited a hospital in Rawalpindi to talk with witnesses injured in the attack that killed Bhutto. In news from Africa, Kenya's president and its opposition leader have agreed to begin negotiations to break the political stalemate following last month's disputed presidential election. On Monday, the top U.S. Africa envoy, Jindai Frazier, urged both sides to talk.
It's obviously clear that some Kenyans don't feel that they have been treated fairly, that they've been, they haven't had their fair share of power and wealth. And so addressing those grievances is necessary. And so those are areas that we think if a dialogue is to help to transform Kenya and prevent a future crisis like we see today, these areas probably need to be part of the agenda. But that's the United States perspective. The agenda will have to be decided by Kenyans themselves.
About 500 Kenyans have died in violence following the election. Another 250,000 have been displaced. For the first time in over a century, the Supreme Court's addressing the legality of a method of execution. Oral arguments were held Monday in a case that'll decide whether lethal injection practices in Kentucky amount to cruel and unusual punishment. Outside the Supreme Court, Attorney Donald Vermilli said the court should ban lethal injections that use a three-drug cocktail.
The obligation here on the state is to bring about a humane execution. That's why we have an Eighth Amendment. That's why we have a prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. It's because it affirms the dignity of our system and our respect for everyone, even those who have committed the most heinous crimes. And that's why the states have got to do what they can to reduce the risk of the awful kind of torture that this method of execution can produce when it goes wrong.
Attorney Roy Englert defended the state of Kentucky.
The state has no obligation to guarantee a pain-free execution, but Kentucky does everything in its power to bring about a pain-free execution.
According to the New York Times, the opponents of lethal injection made little headway Monday in their effort to persuade the court that the Constitution requires states to change the way they carry out executions. Since September, when the High Court agreed to hear this case, there's been a de facto national moratorium of executions by lethal injection. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court scheduled to hear arguments on Indiana's voter ID law. New Jersey's become the first northern state to officially apologize for slavery. The state assembly and Senate passed a resolution declaring slavery shattered the fundamental values of Africans were shattered. Legislators in Alabama, Maryland, North Carolina, and Virginia have also passed resolutions apologizing for slavery. The city of Baltimore is suing Wells Fargo Bank, contending its lending practices discriminated against African American borrowers and led to a wave of foreclosures that has reduced city tax revenues and increased its costs. According to the lawsuit, in 2006, Wells Fargo made high-cost loans to 65% of its black customers in Baltimore, but to only 15% of its white customers in the area. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Food and Drug Administration is preparing to declare that meat and milk from cloned animals and their offspring are safe to eat. Joseph Mendelson of the Center for Food Safety warned about the dangers of cloned livestock. Mendelson said, quote, "Once the FDA says these products are safe and that they're out there, it's very hard to turn it back." And in labor news, the Golden Globe ceremony has been canceled after actors said they would not cross picket lines in support of striking writers. The Writers Guild of America has been on strike since November. Last night, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert returned to the airwaves of Comedy Central with pickets outside, but without their writers.
Can you get a shot of all three of these guys shooting each other, showing there's nothing in the prompters? Now, Jim, what the hell is going on? Where are my words?
We have no script, Stephen.
Why not?
The writers are on strike.
Yeah, I know that, Jim. I'm not a complete idiot. But how does that affect me?
We have nothing to put in the prompter.
No, that's not my understanding of how this works, Jim. My understanding is that this little magic box right here, it reads my thoughts, and then it lays them up on the screen right there into little words that I read, and my audience can hear my thoughts. It's a labor-saving device, Jim. That's how I understand this works.
Well, no, actually, it's what the writers put in.
The writers. The guys on the fourth floor with the opium bongs and playing Guitar Hero all day. You're telling me that those guys are responsible for what I say. I find that a bit of a stretch, Jim. I'm sorry. Get it fixed and get it fixed now.
Stephen Colbert on The Colbert Report on Monday night. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Hampshire goes to the polls today in the second vote of the primary season. On the Democratic side, Iowa victor is Senator Barack Obama's holding a 10-point lead over Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Meanwhile, Republican Senator John McCain is holding a 5-point lead over former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Today's vote caps the quadrennial barrage of political and media attention on Iowa and New Hampshire. Their place at the top of the primary calendar gives these two states enormous sway in deciding the eventual presidential nominees. The differences in candidates' war chests are often a crucial factor in how these votes turn out, and money is aplenty this year. Democratic and Republican presidential hopefuls have already raised more than $420 million, and with that number expected to top $1 billion by campaign's end. We begin our election coverage today with two voices leading calls to reform the system. Rob Ritchie is executive director of Fair Vote. Fair Vote's campaigning for a drastic revision to the primary calendar. He's co-author of the book Every Vote Equal. He joins me in Washington, D.C. And on the telephone, Sheila Krumholz. She's executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a Washington group that follows campaign financing in U.S. elections. I want to start with Sheila Krumholz. Explain the amount of money we're talking about this year, conservatively over $420 million. And how does it compare, to the last presidential election?
Good morning, Amy. Well, we think that the money is quite a bit higher than that. We don't have the final figures for the fourth quarter. But this compares to the last presidential election by about double. We think that this cycle will be about double. Last time it was $500 million. We think this time the nominees alone will need about $500 million each.
Each. Rob Ritchie, how does front-loading, the pushing up of the primary and caucuses, relate to the money?
Well, it does in a couple ways. One is there was so much intense focus on Iowa. It was incredible how much money was spent on this, relatively small state with a relatively low turnout, but the stakes were obviously extremely high, as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are finding out right now. And so they really felt they had to win Iowa, so they poured money in there. But then they also, because of a very compressed schedule, here we are 7 months before the convention, 10 months before the the November election, and it's almost all over. And if some people say if Clinton loses today, that it's sort of over for her. But on February 5th, there really is the final decisive set of primaries where about half the country is voting. And if you don't have a whole lot of money by now, even if you did surprisingly well in Iowa and New Hampshire, it's pretty tough to suddenly compete in the sort of airwave war that we're going to see in just a few weeks.
This moving up of Iowa, New Hampshire, and the other states, the amount of money we're talking about, isn't it at this point the amount of money spent something like three times what was spent so far this time in 2004?
That sounds about right. I don't have the exact figures, but we're talking about a staggering amount this time as compared to any previous cycle. And as Rob was saying, it's the compressed primary season, the increased competition, of course, for this wide-open race, the first fully non-incumbent race in 80 years, the huge number of candidates in the field, and the increase in cost of television advertising, and the increased contribution limits for individuals. It's pegged to inflation now, so it's going to be bumping up each cycle. And at this time, an individual can give a candidate $4,600 for the full cycle. So there's intense interest. There's intense money so far.
Can you talk about television, Sheila Krumholz? How much TV is costing? How much the public airwaves are costing these candidates?
Well, millions and millions. We were looking at the money spent in New Hampshire, and here's the problem. The categorization, the information about the spending is so insufficient because there is not enough information. They're not required to give us exact information about how they're spending the money, where they're spending the money. So, for instance, we have Mitt Romney spending $3 million in New Hampshire. We have Barack Obama spending $1.3 million. Those figures are laughable because, that's less than what any single candidate spent. Big ticket items pass through vendors outside the state. So there really is, it's anyone's best guess what's really being spent.
Rob Ritchie, can you compare, not back to 2004, which is also an astronomical sum of money, let's go back to the beginning of the modern primary system in 68. What happened then, and compare the money then to now, 40 years later?
Well, I don't have the stats on money, but I can certainly talk about the difference in the flow in 68 and just sort of the very different political world we were in. That was the year that Lyndon Johnson was running for re-election, and he started off as the big favorite. But, of course, the Vietnam War was proceeding, and Eugene McCarthy shocked LBJ in New Hampshire, not by winning, but by running so close to him that he recognized that it was going to be a tough re-election bid, and he decided not to run. So suddenly you had an open field and other candidates started emerging, and Robert Kennedy could still jump in. And they went through a series of primaries that weren't compressed. It went over time. And the big vote in California where Robert Kennedy was assassinated right afterwards, that was a very extremely important vote way in June. We had those kinds of extended important primary votes in 76 when Jimmy Carter won and Jerry Brown could jump in the race and kind of make that interesting and actually win California late in the race. In 1984, when Walter Mondale, lost to Gary Hart in New Hampshire, and then they went through a series of primaries. 1988, where Jesse Jackson could win several primaries. And again, kind of a longer season where the debate, not just about who's going to win or lose, but about the future of the party and about some really big decisions. And we're having that conversation almost truncated just by the polls and by, 1/60th of America voting in Iowa and New Hampshire. And
How was
and then
the
we'll
order,
suddenly be down to the general election.
Rob Ritchie, how was the order determined?
It's Iowa and New Hampshire have this self-proclaimed right to be first. And New Hampshire, says we're first in the nation as a primary. They must be frustrated that they let Iowa slip in as the first caucus, which was the way it started with Iowa not being defined as a primary. And the parties and the leading candidates tend to be a bit craven about challenging that role. So that's that self-proclaimed right, and the parties essentially ratified that with party rules. But then going into this cycle, they said that there shouldn't be any votes except for a handful, and we'll see some Nevada and South Carolina voting in a few weeks, before February 5th. But then they said it's open season. So every state's saying, well, we don't want to be out of this. And so many states said, well, if we want to be relevant, we've got to move our primary up. And that's when so many big states and almost half the country in the number of states moved it up to February 5th. And that was sort of a every state for itself kind of free-for-all.
Sheila Krumholz, talk about the industries that are funding the candidates.
You know, the sources of cash, the big story is that the sources of cash are pretty consistent on both sides of the aisle and for all candidates, really. I mean, what the story is, it's lawyers and law firms, it's securities and investments, Wall Street, it's retired people. And, of course, these are not your average pensioners. These are probably retired titans of industry that are still connected and giving campaign cash. And real estate is a huge source of money. That's true for the Democrats as well as the Republicans. So what we then focus on is, well, what's standing out? For Ron Paul, it's computers and Internet. That's a first. But when you're talking about, for instance, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, it's lawyers at $9.5 million for Hillary Clinton, securities and investments, so Wall Street at $4.7 million, and then for Barack Obama, lawyers at $7.9 million, and retired is his second category, $4.9 million. So that is something that is consistent back in time. But again, there are a few standouts. Education has been bumping up. Education has given more to Barack Obama this time, $2.1 million by the third quarter, as compared to just $1.6 million for Hillary Clinton. TV, movies, music, Hollywood is about even for both of them, but a big source for Democratic campaign cash.
Well, Rob Ritchie, how do you fix the system?
It's eminently fixable. That's one of the intriguing things. I mean, almost everything that's really broken in our system, like the Electoral College and plurality elections and single-member districts, all these things, our voter registration system, really can be changed with political will and statutory changes. This one is actually really can be led by the parties themselves. And the Republicans may take the lead. They have a big meeting of their Rules Committee January 17th. And they are apparently starting a process, which they actually almost did in 2000, to revamp their schedule. The general approach that that they like, and a version of it is what our group and some others recommend, is a graduated primary process where you do have states with small populations voting first, but then you have a break in time, so you can kind of break this momentum, and then have states, a relatively bigger number of states, but not that many more voting, and stretch it out more. And there's ways to structure the schedule that it's pretty likely that almost every state would, in every election, have a meaningful vote. And we'd have an ongoing conversation about the future of democracy within a party that I think we're really going to miss out on this time.
And the whole story of the Electoral College, what each of these primaries and caucuses mean, Rob?
For the Electoral College or within the
structure of the system works. When a candidate wins a state, what does it mean?
Oh, it's an interesting fact. You know, one of our beliefs is that we should follow most of the rest of the world that has been holding elections in highly democratic countries and use proportional representation. And actually, that's what the Democrats require of primaries and caucuses. So any candidate that gets at least 15% of the vote wins that share of delegates, so that a convention is a reflection of candidates' backers who at least got over 15%. The Republicans do that in a mix. And actually, what makes it very volatile for Republicans is they're about to enter a season where a lot of their primaries and caucuses are winner-take-all, and whoever finishes first, no matter how low the percentage, will win all that state's delegates. So if they go into February 5th with a fractured field, and Giuliani can win states, and Huckabee can win states, and Romney and McCain, they kind of win different states, they could really just have a weird sort of set of results. So proportional representation is part of the process. In Iowa, the Democrats had a dynamic where they had instant runoff voting for the people who backed someone who wasn't viable at a caucus, who didn't have 15%. Those backers of those candidates could move to their second choice, just like an instant runoff election, which we recommend for general elections and ones where we want to accommodate choice and third parties and independents. The problem was, by the way, a lot of people have only focused on the delegate results on the Democratic side, not the straw poll vote, the kind of the first vote, so that people who voted for Kucinich or Biden or Richardson or weren't, you know, in the viable standard, we actually never know what their votes were. So they look like they did a lot worse than they did. So kind of the instant runoff reality would have been better if they'd allowed those votes to be tallied and reported and then still let those people go to their second choice and then get the final delegate count with more people being able to chance to help elect a delegate.
And in the overall general election, how the Electoral College works and the whole push to have it abolished?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. One quiet story from last week is the state of New Jersey passed the National Popular Vote Plan and sent it to John Corzine, who's likely to sign it, to make the second state to enter this interstate agreement. And that's the way we think can change the Electoral College. But we're not going to have that in place this year. What this year, every state votes for president, or every voter votes for president, but they actually don't vote directly for the person. They're voting for a set of electors in each state that will then turn around and, you hope, vote for the person. And whoever wins a state gets all of those states' electors in almost every state. And so any state that's not seen as competitive, as balanced enough that campaign activity might change the result, is completely ignored. Not just somewhat ignored, just absolutely ignored. And then there's big states like Florida and Ohio that are close and big get almost all the attention. It's just incredible distortions of campaigning. So we're about to enter a season where, you know, most of the country, including most of the big states and big cities and most of the small states and most states overall, are just going to be completely ignored by the candidates. And a national popular vote would have every vote equal. That's the name of this recent book, Every Vote Equal. And it is something that a lot of people thought we needed to change the Constitution to establish a national popular vote. But it turns out that states have the power to do it themselves. It's like Dorothy in Kansas being able to get home by clicking her shoes. They determine how to allocate electoral votes, and they have the power to enter into interstate agreements with one another. So the idea of New Jersey and Maryland, which is the other state that has passed this, is they will give all of their electoral votes to the slate of the candidate who wins the national popular vote and do it once the number of participating states can guarantee election of the president. And that plan is moving forward in a number of states. It's actually been introduced in almost every single state. I think it's going to pass in several more this year. We'll see another lousy presidential election in the sense of political equality being completely thrown out the window. And I think we'll have it in place by 2012. So one bright light about reform opportunities is we can actually change the way we elect for president by state action. And then also the parties can change this presidential primary process. So we may have a whole different kind of presidential election in 2012.
Rob Ritchie, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of Fair Vote, co-author of Every Vote Equal, and Sheila Krumholz, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. That's a Washington watchdog that follows campaign financing in U.S. elections. You can go to Open Secrets to see how much the candidates have raised and from whom they have raised it. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. We'll be right back. Tom Waits, Knife Chase, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 650 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 150 are around the world. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue on election news. New Hampshire is not just known as a key primary state. It's also gained attention for hosting one of the biggest election scandals of the last decade. On election day in November 2002, the telephone lines at the New Hampshire Democrats' voting headquarters received scores of hang-up calls in a phone-jamming scheme intended to block a Democratic get-out-the-vote campaign. The Republicans won the Senate race with John Sununu beating out the Democratic Governor Gene Shaheen for the Senate seat. Two top Republican campaign officials were later convicted, Charles McGee, then the executive director of the New Hampshire Republican Party, and James Tobin, then the Northeast regional director of the Republican National Committee. Tobin's conviction was later overturned pending a retrial. Democrats say the scheme may have gone higher than New Hampshire Republicans. According to phone records, Tobin made two dozen calls to the White House in the 24-hour period before and after the election. Also convicted was the head of the telemarketing firm that made the calls on behalf of his Republican clients. Alan Raymond and his company, GOP Marketplace, received more than $15,000 for the phone jamming scheme. Raymond served 3 months in prison in 2006. Now, Alan Raymond has come out with a tell-all book. It's called How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. In addition to the phone jamming scheme, Raymond details other Republican tactics. In a New Jersey congressional race in 2000, Raymond's firm used scripted, phony, automated phone messages to try to play on white voters' racial prejudices. Carefully selected white households were called with a pre-recorded message featuring an African-American speaker urging listeners to vote Democratic. Union households were called with a similar message, but this time with an actor speaking in a heavy Spanish accent. Republicans thought this would take advantage of worker fears of losing their jobs to Latin American immigrants. Alan Raymond joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Good morning.
Well, let's start in New Hampshire on Election Day 2002. What were you doing?
Well, on Election Day in 2002 in New Hampshire, we were—it was one of many clients that we had, but in New Hampshire, our client was the New Hampshire Republican State Committee. And we were conducting what later became known as the phone jamming operation, which was an effort to jam telephone lines at a volunteer phone bank in Manchester, New Hampshire, with the intent to disrupt lines of communication. In other words, to disrupt Democrats' effort to get out the vote on Election Day there.
And explain exactly, well, first of all, who told you to do this? Who engaged you? Who hired your firm, GOP Marketplace?
Sure, sure. I was originally approached, and this is all detailed in the book, but I was originally approached by Jim Tobin, who'd been a former colleague of mine. I had worked at the RNC in more or less the same position that he had at that time, although in a different region of the country. And we had known each other, and he approached me and kind of described the idea of jamming the phone lines and asked me if it could be done. And, you know, like anything, the answer to that is, you know, anything could be done. Anything's possible. And so at that point, he just, you know, gave me, told me to expect a call from Chuck McGee, who was then the executive director of the New Hampshire Republican Party. And then about, you know, a few days later, Mr. McGee gave me a call, detailed again the program as it had been described to me by Mr. Tobin, and, you know, clearly indicated he wanted to proceed. And so so at that point, we took it seriously. And even though I recognized it as an unusual program, I took it seriously because the original entree to me, the approach to me, had been made by an agent of the RNC in New England. So it was not something to be dismissed lightly.
Did you check with lawyers?
I did, actually. I was I had another job at the time as well, running a 527 issue advocacy group, and I did speak with the attorney there. And
explain what you mean by 527, Al.
A 527 is a it's an IRS classification. Essentially, in this context, for instance, your listeners might be most familiar with Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. That was a 527 committee, and what they do is they advocate issues in the context of elections. And so this attorney had been the attorney for this particular group, and I did run it by him, and we went back and forth in a few conversations. And in advance of Election Day in 2002, he came back to me and said, while he didn't recommend it, he didn't see it as being illegal. And that's an important distinction, because in this business, it's not necessarily about morality. People like me are hired to engineer victory. And so one of the things that you learn early on is that oftentimes you're going right up to the bright line of the law, which is fine. I mean, that's the reason that you have law. You're supposed to stay on the lawful side of the law, which I did not, and paid the consequences for that. We can get into that, I'm sure, later. But anyway, I did consult with an attorney, got the green light, and we moved forward.
And what did you do?
Well, frankly, as it comes down, it was a very simple, almost prankish crank call type of thing. We just had people on the phones redialing these six numbers that we'd been provided by the New Hampshire Republican Party and Mr. McGee with the intent to jam up those phone lines.
Where were the calls coming from?
Well, what we did is we subcontracted it. We outsourced it to a small operation, a small telemarketing firm in Idaho. And they did the actual calls. But we were the vendor. We were the ones that the New Hampshire Republican State Party was paying to do the work.
And what were the places you called?
Well, there were two places. One place, and it was the essentially it was a Democratic phone bank operation in concert with a volunteer effort by the Manchester Fire Department.
And they were doing a get out the vote campaign in the morning. They were making calls to urge people to go to the polls.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, more of a clearinghouse of information, where your poll is located, what time polls open, what time they close, how to get there, do you need assistance, that type of thing, the type of thing that both parties more or less do and have done forever on Election Day.
And this involved a very close race for Senate between Jeanne Shaheen, the former governor, and John Sununu, who is the senator from New Hampshire now.
That was certainly one of the races on the ballot that day, and as it turned out, a very important race that dictated control of the U.S. Senate. I think that it would be hard to make an argument that this effort had any real impact on that contest. But yes, that was a very important and, fairly close race as far as U.S. Senate races go, yes.
And explain how you got discovered and how you ended up being indicted, convicted, and served time in jail.
Sure, yeah. I don't want to give away all the stuff about the book, but—and let me say, too, the reason that I wrote this book is—and I like to quote Justice Brandeis in Buckley v. Vallejo, which was, sunlight's the best disinfectant. What I'm doing here is I'm being completely candid and transparent about my experience in the Republican Party from more or less the beginning of the Republican Revolution to its demise in 2006, which is when I actually was incarcerated. But— the whole point is to, bring sunlight to this process so that voters have an opportunity to understand what happens and really ask themselves what I think is an important question, which is, why me? Why am I getting this particular piece of direct mail or seeing this television spot or radio spot or maybe even email? Why is a candidate telling me something? What is it they expect me to do? Now, to get to your question, I'm sorry, I went off track there. Ask me that question
again.
Yeah,
I was just asking how you ended up being discovered, indicted, sure, et cetera.
Well, I got a phone call from a Lieutenant Roach in the Manchester Police Department who was following up an inquiry into this. And he gave me a call. He told me that, at the time, he said, there's nothing that can be done about it, but he warned me off doing it again. And I breathed a sigh of relief. I'd never been contacted by any type of law enforcement before on anything I'd ever done in politics. And I kind of set it aside, but I did put a call into my former colleague who'd called me about the job, Mr. Tobin, and relayed to him what happened. And it's one of these phone conversations, you know, you never forget, which was I described the conversation. He said, I have no idea what you're talking about. To which I said, you know, the job in New Hampshire we did for the state party, the phone jamming thing. And he said, I have no clue what you're talking about. And I kind of called him on the bluff. I said, of course you do, Jim. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And he said, yeah, now I remember. Okay, well, you know, see ya. And that was the last time I ever talked to him. So, and at that point, you know, I didn't think anything was going to come of it until on, I think it was February 7th, I picked up the newspaper, online, I went to the Manchester Union Leader. And sure enough, there was an article in there describing how the Manchester Police Department had referred the matter to the Department of Justice. And at that point, seeing how I was being treated by my former client, I knew I was the guy who was going to get fingered and thrown under the bus. And I accepted that paradigm because that's part of what you do. And I never talked to the press. In fact, it wasn't until I was released that I ever spoke to the press. But I did make a conscious decision, which was I'm not going to talk about this issue. I'm not going to, you know, point fingers at my client or anybody else. However, if the Department of Justice or the Federal Bureau of Investigation ever knocked on my door, the first thing I was going to do was be candid, transparent, and tell them everything that happened, because at that point it wasn't about politics anymore. It was about, you know, as maybe some of your listeners will understand, it's about your life and what's really important. Mm.
Now, you weren't just running this company, GOP Marketplace, as a businessman. You were—you had a number of important positions within the Republican Party. Just going back through them, you ran a successful U.S. House campaign in 94 for William Martini, a Republican Party politician who represented New Jersey's 8th Congressional District, subsequently chosen by the former GOP chair, current Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, to become one of the regional directors of the Republican National Committee, overseeing the Mid-Atlantic states, a position as chief of staff to co-chair of the Republican National Committee that Patricia Harrison followed, who's now over at Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In 2000, you worked as deputy political director of Steve Forbes' presidential campaign. And you also served as executive director of the Republican Leadership Council. Then you went off into private business, is that right, to do this electoral work for Republicans. My question is, how high up did this go, that issue of the dozens of phone calls made to the White House within the time of the jamming campaign?
Well, let me say, first and foremost, I have no evidence that anyone in the White House or anyone beyond Jim Tobin at the Republican National Committee had any advance awareness or approved this program. Having said that, and having worked at the Republican National Committee, and this gets back to why I took on the work, is I know the process. The Republican National Committee is an organization of professionals. You know, these aren't hacks. If there's two things that I learned working there is, one, an unusual program, which this clearly was. You know, it spoke for itself when it was first described to me. Something so unusual doesn't see the light of day unless it's been vetted. The other thing that I assessed, which was when I worked at the RNC in the same capacity, I never really cared too much about who the vendor was unless I was involved in delivering the money that was going to be used to pay that vendor. So those are two important criteria in my mind at the time. When Mr. Tobin gives me a call as the agent of the Republican National Committee, you know, what I assess is that, well, he's calling me as an agent of the RNC, and he must be bringing the money because he has a level of concern of who's going to do the work. And so, that's an important assessment to make. But again, I have to say, in all fairness, and I'm going to be more fair to them than they were to me, I have no knowledge that this reaches beyond Mr. Tobin at the RNC, and certainly I've never seen any evidence that it reaches into the White House.
Although you're right, Alan Raymond, the Bush White House had complete control of the RNC, and there was no way someone like Tobin was going to try what he was proposing without first getting it vetted by his higher-ups.
Right, and that's what I was saying, which is, while I've never seen any evidence, I've never seen a phone record, an email, been told of a conversation, I do know, and it's practical knowledge, that when you have a sitting president They do control the institution, the Republican National Committee, or if it were a Democratic president, the Democratic National Committee. They do control their affiliated committees because it's in a political arm of the White House. So, yes, there is de facto control. Absolutely.
We're talking to Alan Raymond. He wrote, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. You talk about other manipulations of elections, rigging of elections that you were involved with. Talk about New Jersey and talk about the phone calls that you were having made.
Well, by that, I think you're referring to, let's see, the 2000 I guess it was the 2000 congressional race that you referred to earlier. And I think, again, this gets to what I said earlier. You know, the question to ask yourself is why? Why am I getting this phone call? And I'll go to the one about free trade using Hispanic or Latin accents. And the point there is to create cross pressure. So if you call a Democratic household that you're fairly certain is maybe even a union household, opposed to legislation such as, or policy such as NAFTA, the National, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which a union household is going to perceive as a threat to their job. If you make that phone call that says, you know, talking about NAFTA in that accent, you're going to create cross pressure because you're going to be saying to that household, you know, while, you know, depending on who they support, they may be in conflict, and they may just throw up their hands and say, you know what, I'm not going to vote. I'm just going to stay home. Or they may cast a vote that ultimately is not in their best interest. So what you're doing is you're another example might be, you know, call if you're a Republican, calling into what you've identified as a Green Party-leaning household and encouraging them to vote for the Green Party. Because more than likely, that household is going to be a Democratic voting household if they're not a Green Party household. So essentially, you're polarizing, you're dividing, and that's how you win in politics. I mean, as I said earlier, this is not about morality. This is about winning, but winning in a way that you stay on the right side of the law, which, again, as your listeners know, is something I violated and paid a stiff price for. But nonetheless, the idea is to win, you need 50% plus one. That means half the electorate plus one vote. And sometimes it's not even a majority. Sometimes it's just a plurality. So this is about polarization. It is about division. And it is about wedge issues.
Talk about the phone calls that you were having made in New Jersey to using the voice of, as you put it, a ghetto black guy calling households to ask them to vote Democrat.
Yeah, that's an automated call. And again, the design was to tap into what might be there. I'm not saying, you know, every white household has racial bias, but the intent there is to tap into something that might be latent, something that might be within that household that drives them to, again, either stay home or vote against their best interest on other issues. So, again, this is all about motivation, persuasion, and, you know, it's powerful stuff.
I was thinking about Ed Rollins, who, according to Wired, was named the campaign manager of Mike Huckabee, in the national campaign chair of Mike Huckabee. Go back a lot of years, about 15 years, to when he was boasting as campaign manager for Christine Todd Whitman about spending something like $500,000 for walking around money from the state Republican Party to depress the vote in urban, heavily Democratic areas to pay, for example, black ministers not to urge not to urge people in their congregations to go out and vote, to suppress the black vote. Now he's being resuscitated.
Right. I was actually in New Jersey that cycle, running the reelection campaign for two assemblymen, Steve Cordemus and Tom Smith. And ironically, in this case for me, you know, Tom Smith, who served with great distinction in the assembly, was African American, and I was running the campaign for both gentlemen, and both were outstanding assemblymen, great public servants, And I remember that, and I also remember, for the record, that Mr. Rollins later came out and repudiated his statements about this walking around stuff. I think some of that's bravado, but I'll tell you, I mean, you know, my experience in working in New Jersey politics was, you know, this goes back a long time, and laws have changed, and things don't operate the way they used to, but there was such thing as walking around money, and it did get spread around. I personally never saw any money delivered to a black minister with the quid pro quo agreement that they were going to urge their congregation, their flock, to stay home. So I can't speak to that. I do remember it occurring, and I do remember a lot of people, anyway, Republicans at the time thinking, you know, one, if it's true, why are you talking about it? And two, why are you talking about it? You know, what's to be gained from that? Because it was the election that Governor Whitman won her first term. So, and now he's back in play. And I saw an article about him talking tough about Governor Romney. And, you know, apparently it hasn't helped Governor Huckabee's campaign too much in New Hampshire. But, you know, we're going into South Carolina. It is a dirty, nasty place for politics. It's a lovely state, obviously, but it's a nasty place. You've already seen mailings into that state accusing tying Governor Romney to polygamy, and I think you're going to see more of this stuff. There's a history there. You know, everyone's fairly familiar with the events of 2000 involving Senator McCain. So, you know, I think it's going to be—it's going to get rougher. Because that's the nature of the beast.
You're referring to 2000 election, the Bush campaign, George W. Bush, now the president, spreading rumors about John McCain having a black child.
Yes, and it's never, and again, just for the record, I don't think it's ever been tied to the Bush White House, the Bush campaign, but it stands to reason who had the most to gain. So, but it is.
Well, Alan Raymond, I want to thank you for being with us. You are the great-grandson of the founder of Underwood Typewriter Company. What are you doing today?
After you've been through what I've been through, you take a lot of time to assess. Certainly writing the book took some time. I'm pleased with it because it's an opportunity for people to pick up the book, understand more about the process, and kind of open their eyes and understand what's going on so they can make informed decisions.
I want to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Alan Raymond is the author. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we head to Manchester, New Hampshire. We're going to talk to some students who went up to New Hampshire to work for Republican candidates, Ron Paul and John McCain. Stay with us.
Last for infinity. USA will not last for infinity. San Francisco, New Wave Disco. Capitalism is a super system.
Dynasty Electric here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New Hampshire. Voters have begun casting their ballots in the country's first primary of the 2008 election. The Democratic race, Hillary Clinton trails Barack Obama by double digits in the polls 5 days after finishing second in the Iowa caucuses. She actually finished third. Clinton has vowed to stay in the race until Super Tuesday on February 5th, when 22 states hold nominating contests. John Edwards and Bill Richardson trail a distant third and fourth. On the Republican side, surveys show John McCain holding a narrow lead over Mitt Romney. Meanwhile, Mike Huckabee, the GOP winner in Iowa, is far behind, bunched with Rudy Giuliani and Ron Paul. Two tiny hamlets in New Hampshire, Dixville Notch and Hart's Location, opened their polling stations at midnight, giving small early victories to Obama and McCain. Most of the rest of the state began voting at 6 a.m. local time. Polls close at 8 p.m. First results expected shortly afterward. State election officials have predicted a record turnout in New Hampshire of more than 500,000 voters, many of them independents. Student volunteers have flooded the state to campaign for their candidates. Yesterday, we spoke with students volunteering for Democratic candidates. Today, two students from St. Olaf College campaigning for Republican hopefuls. Daniel Wick is with us with the Ron Paul campaign, and Matt Gallagher is with the McCain campaign. Matt, talk about, as you stand there in the New Hampshire cold, talk about why McCain.
Well, it's better than the Minnesota cold right now. Juan McCain, I feel that America, and particularly the youth of America, are sick of the partisanship that's been going on in Washington, D.C. And I feel that McCain is really the only Republican candidate willing to—he's in the past, and he will in the future, I believe—reach across the aisle.
And what is it most that you like, outside of being bipartisan, about his record?
You know, I believe we can trust him. As a Republican, you know, he has reached across the aisle. I don't know if I can say I agreed with everything he's done, but at least I know where he stands. And I don't know if that's the case with our current president. You know, when he was campaigning, he campaigned as a unifier. I don't know if that exactly happened, but I believe I can trust him. And, you know, I think that's important to the American people after 8 years of President Bush.
I want to turn to Daniel Wick. You are supporting Ron Paul. Why?
Yes, I am. Well, I actually found Ron online on YouTube this summer. and I just, some of the points he made, I was especially attracted to his foreign policy when he started talking about how we're paying billions of dollars to destroy and rebuild Iraq's infrastructure, where, being from Minnesota, we know the kind of condition this country's infrastructure's in. So it was, you know, it was very interesting to kind of hear that come from a Republican candidate, and I was really attracted to that.
You didn't see him in the debate, in the Fox debate in New Hampshire.
No.
Despite the fact he won, he has raised $20 million, had a 10% showing in the New Hampshire polls. He was excluded while he got more votes in Iowa than Rudy Giuliani, who was included in that debate. Your response, Daniel?
You know, I just thought that was very ridiculous, because I understand the need to have criteria for people to be in the debates. You know, people with 1% of the vote, which is actually—I've seen Fred Thompson with 1% of the vote in a few polls here in New Hampshire. You know, in legitimate criteria. But when someone does as well as Ron Paul's doing, it's just—it just feeds the whole idea that the, you know, mainstream media is trying to marginalize Ron Paul. And it's just—I just can't believe that they'd actually do something like that.
Daniel, is war an issue for you and Ron Paul's opposition to the war in Iraq?
You know, I was always a war supporter for a long time, until I kind of started following Ron Paul. And it's, you know, it's just, I think it's what the Republicans are saying right now about how, oh, they hate us for our freedom and everything like that. I just don't think we've had enough time to see if that's actually true or not. And, you know, I
Matt
think
Gallagher,
it would be interesting.
Your view on war, Matt Gallagher?
Yeah, no problem. You know, I believe, I don't know if we should have gone in Iraq. You know, of course, hindsight is 20/20. But I do believe that McCain was the only one. He was the only one in Congress, in the Senate, to stand up to the Bush policy and to Donald Rumsfeld and said, no, what we're doing is not working. What we need is just a surge. And, you know, the McCain surge, it's showing now, you know, it's evident that it's working. So I don't know if we should be in Iraq, though. But, you know, if we're going to destroy the infrastructure, you know, destroy the country, I certainly think we need to rebuild it. And I think
Matt Gallagher, we're going to leave it there. Matt Gallagher and Daniel Wick. Matt Gallagher from St. Olaf College campaigning for John McCain. Daniel Wick, also from St. Olaf College, supporting Ron Paul. They are speaking to us from Manchester. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire from Dukadus, Aaron Matteangeli, Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.